to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
So how's your morning going so far?
I think our morning's going pretty good. It's a Sunday morning and it was daylight savings time. So waking up this morning, technically sort of like an hour later.
We kind of lose an hour. Yeah. I don't understand the... I think it used to do something with like farming and agriculture or something, but I don't understand the point of daylight savings time anymore.
I guess I'll have to Google it because I don't know either. But yeah. I do like having the longer days, but now that means the mornings are going to be dark again. But it'll lighten up.
Well, faster. Here in Washington, though, come June, July, May, June, July, the sun comes up at like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, it's so nice.
It's pretty wild. The difference between, we've been back in Washington since 2017. We lived in the Southwest in Vegas for 15 years, just shy of 15 years. Mm-hmm. And there the sunrise and sunset doesn't change too much.
I remember it changing, but certainly not as drastically as it does here.
Here, it's a remarkably different. The sun doesn't come up until 8 o'clock in the wintertime, and it comes up at 4 o'clock in the summertime. It's pretty wild. I think just now we're finally getting used to it, but it took us a while. It took me a few years to sort of adjust to that. Mm-hmm. It reminds me when I was in the Midwest, in Wisconsin and Minnesota. It was kind of like that there, right? The winters are... although this year I talked to my mom and, some of my family back there, their winter this year has been very weird. No snow, not even really all that cold. February, there's green grass. March, there's green grass everywhere. My mom has been there pretty much her whole life. Actually, her entire life. She's 78, mm-hmm. and she's never seen a winter like that before, or a lack thereof, whatever. Our winter has been pretty mild for the most part. Can't complain too much.
There were some pretty cold days, but honestly,
it was like a week.
I didn't mind. Yeah, it was 1 week.
We got pretty lucky as far as that goes. So today we're going to, granted, we get questions all the time. If you ever want to ask a question, read it on the podcast, just go to our website, progresshealth.com. There is somewhere, it's going to be moving around a little bit. We're going to highlight a little bit better. Just a tab called Ask the Doctor. Click on that. Put your name and email. Ask your question. We'll read it on the podcast. We encourage those kind of questions because we want to understand what people's own, their own language that they're using. What questions do people specifically have? And like we've said many times, if you have a question, then there's probably thousands, if not, tens of thousands of other women that are having a similar question. So, that's a nice way for us to engage with each other or with everyone. So this was actually a question that came from a patient of mine a couple weeks ago, about 10 days ago. And she asked the question, is perimenopause the same thing as early menopause? What are your thoughts about that?
I thought that was a great question because it kind of makes you pause for a little bit because you think, well, could it be? But I mean, when I think about the language, is perimenopause the same as early menopause? My first answer would be no, it's not.
Right.
I can understand where somebody might ask that.
Yeah, sure. For someone that doesn't really understand, I'm not saying that, our listeners, I know they're very savvy and they do a mm-hmm. lot of research and there's a lot of social media and YouTube and TikTok and Instagram videos talking about perimenopause these days. I even talked to a patient the other day that, just until recently, perimenopause was never really talked about. I know you and I've noticed this shift over the last decade, where more and more women are asking better questions, and now there's more content around that kind of an issue. At first, when she asked the question, I'm like, I had to like sit in there and literally think about it for a second. I'm like, wait a minute, you're right. The first thing my first reaction was no. So why don't we dive into that a little bit and you give me your take on it.
Well, before we jump into that, I'm curious as to with this patient, was she trying to understand is she in perimenopause or is she in menopause?
Yeah, she's she's in her later 40s. Actually, she's, I think she's, I have to look now and remember. They all kind of run together a little bit, but I think she might actually be 50, but still in perimenopause.
Yes. Yeah. So sometimes people think as soon as you hit that 50, like, oh, I must be menopause. I must be in menopause. But if you're still menstruating, if you have a uterus and you're still menstruating, then you would technically be in perimenopause. Because, you know, with perimenopause, I kind of think of it as totally different in some ways than menopause, but it's like a phase, just like with puberty. You don't jump into puberty and then jump right out of puberty. It's like a phase. You kind of glide into it and then you glide out of it. Just like with perimenopause, you'll see the changes in the hormones. They're different than the complete cessation of the estrogen and progesterone that you see in menopause. But in some ways, in early menopause, so that's where it has like that. That's why I liked this question, because there is a little bit of gray area where someone, you know, is going through perimenopause and they're just starting to miss their periods, maybe missing them for several months, and they are kind of gliding into menopause. There is a little bit of a gray area there, but I still wouldn't call it early menopause. I wouldn't call perimenopause at all technically early menopause. Early menopause I think of as more as like ovarian failure, which is very rare, which is definitely not common, but where the ovaries actually stop making the hormones quite early. Like you can see it sometimes in the 30s, the late 30s, because I have a lot of women that do go into menopause maybe in their 40s, and that's okay. Everybody's different. You know, menopause, what do they say? The average age is 51.5 is menopause, but a lot of women, depending on, you know, has no issues of lifestyle or anything, probably a little genetics. They might go into menopause at 44 or 47. Some women I have in their mid-50s that are just waiting for menopause.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned ovarian failure. So do you think ovarian failure is just early menopause? Or do you think that, at least sort of, maybe not exactly, but do you think that those are sort of similar things? Let's say a woman's in her late 30s and her FSH is really, really high or something like that. She's not having a period. Would that be considered menopause?
Yeah, I would consider that. And then maybe that could be, maybe if you want to use that verbiage. I mean, some women, like I said, it's very rare for ovarian failure can have that happen in their 20s. So like I said, I wouldn't consider that early menopause. I don't know. I mean, you could say somebody in their late 30s or early 40s could be early menopause, but I think it just depends on the individual.
Yeah, well, amenorrhea, so not having a period, wouldn't be the only thing that you would say that they're either an ovarian failure, because there are lots of things that can stop a woman's period.
Absolutely.
Right, so that's a blanket statement that, you know, I'm sort of prefacing a little bit that it's not, you know, black or white, that just because you're not having a period doesn't mean you're in menopause. But if you did some lab work, you know, specific in FSH and did a couple of things, it would look very similar to a woman that's in menopause. And just the difference would be their age.
True. And then there's some things you can do to differentiate whether it's, you know, ovarian failure or if it's not. And that's a whole nother podcast. Yeah, 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 yeah. But there was, you know, something that you had mentioned earlier, you know, talking here that, you know, in the last decade, we haven't, you know, you and I have dealt with perimenopause since we started practice for me, 2004, for you, 2003, but it hasn't really been talked about. People didn't really know what perimenopause was. They know what menopause is. They know what hypothyroid is. They even know what adrenal fatigue and adrenal insufficiency is, but they didn't really know exactly what is perimenopause. So now it's, you know, much more talked about, I would say, in the last probably 4 to 5 years, maybe even a little less than that, maybe more like 3 years, that you really see a lot of talk about perimenopause, that I could see where, you know, this question should be defined in a way that, no, you know, perimenopause is not early menopause. It's technically before menopause.
Yeah, yeah. Because if you're going into early menopause, that means your perimenopausal phase was just early perimenopause, right? It's, you still, in some ways, now, I mean, I guess depending on what's going on with the person's situation, let's say they have a really high stress level. Let's say there's something going on, some kind of, you know, whatever, I don't know, a divorce, a loss of a loved one, some really traumatic situation that's really stressful. You know, those stress hormones certainly have an impact on those female hormones. Let's say they went from being a regular menstruating woman, and all of a sudden they just go into early menopause. So I guess in some sense, that's why this is such an interesting thing, because there is a lot of exceptions to the rule, right? I guess you could go from being just a regular menstruating age woman to menopause just like that. But more than likely, if you're going into early menopause, what would you define as making a statement, but asking a question. So what would you define age-wise? What would be early menopause in your mind?
For me, it would be the early 40s, because you think about, you know, we want those hormones are important. You know, estrogen is really great for the bones. It's good for the heart. It's good for the brain. So somebody going into menopause, say at 42, where that estrogen has dropped down, versus a woman that has gone into menopause at 52, when that estrogen drops down, that woman that is 52 has had 10 years more of estrogen, you know, levels in her body. So that's where you would, you know, because like I said, estrogen is very, you know, bone protective. It's really great for, you know, bone density, that you want to, you know, I would treat a woman in their early 40s going through menopause a lot differently than I would treat a woman in their, you know, early 50s.
Sure. So that means then, so I was going to say something probably under the age of 45 would be kind of early menopause, right?
But I have seen women, and I wouldn't say it's not like a diagnosis or dysfunctional or anything. It's just everybody's different. A lot of times it has to do, like if you'll ask a patient, well, do you remember when your mom or your grandma went into menopause? And usually you'll see kind of these women kind of fall in line with the same time. You know, you'll see that too.
Right. I always ask that all the time. Like when did mom or grandma, you know, go through the transition? When do they start having symptoms? And usually it's within a couple of years of each other. All three of them, mom, grandma, and daughter, or mom, grandma, and sister siblings, they're all, you know, relatively clustered in relatively the same same time frame.
So I, you know, one thing about this question, I think that's why it kind of sparked my interest, is maybe not so now, because what is it, you know, 2024, but you know, even like 10 years ago and, you know, 2014, I remember patients coming in to see me telling me that their doctor was telling them they're in menopause. And we'll talk a little bit about the labs, because you had mentioned an FSH level and doing some lab work. And what the doctors have done, they've done some lab work and they'll say, oh yeah, you know, these reference ranges are ridiculous. In my opinion, I'm saying they're ridiculous, but a lot of times a woman that is in perimenopause may look like they're in menopause on some of this blood work that gets taken, but they're not. So like I was saying, I'll have these women come in, and I've had it many times, saying, oh, my doctor says I'm in menopause, but they're still having a period.
Every month.
I do blood testing a little bit differently for hormones. So I do them differently to really differentiate.
You actually test them.
Yeah. Well, partly that. And, you know, I do feel like a woman in perimenopause that might be having some symptoms that we want to address, you know, for quality of life, for longevity, for anti-aging, is going to be different how I'm going to address it in someone with menopause, where, you know, you love your GPs, you love your gynecologists. They're they have their role, that they may not treat menopause and perimenopause. They might actually group it all into one. So that's where, you know, we kind of have a little bit of a different philosophy and what our niche is.
Well, I think it comes down to what women are looking for in the 21st century, right? Believe me, I didn't graduate in 2003 thinking I was going to deal with female hormones, but sometimes the market just sort of, you know, pushes you that way, right? That's what you've done pretty much ever since, and rightly so. I just evolved sort of doing the same thing. But women are, and that's why it's transition. When we first started practice, all menopause, right? That's pretty much all we saw, women that were, you know, let's say for the most part, over 50. But in the last several years, it's shifted a little bit, where we're seeing equal amounts or just as many in their late 30s, early to mid to late 40s, as opposed to just predominantly menopausal women. And I don't know exactly why that is, but I do think that maybe speculating, which is why we sort of focused on a little bit perimenopause specifically, is there's lots of treatment. And this kind of question, perimenopause versus early menopause, really determines from the practitioner's side, you alluded to it just a second ago, how you'd end up treating that patient, right? So you want to define where they're at, because that will determine what treatments they receive. Like you mentioned just a second ago, if a woman's having a period, she's not in menopause, right?
Yeah.
I mean, plain and simple.
We talked about the labs too. Like you had mentioned the FSH, the follicle stimulating hormone. Sometimes that's a signal from the brain, the follicle stimulating hormone, from the pituitary, and it monitors overall ovarian status. So if the ovaries are starting to reduce their production, you know, in estrogen, progesterone, but really mainly estrogen, you'll see that FSH number go up. Now, in a perimenopausal female, they might still be having a period if they have a uterus. oftentimes you can see that FSH move around a lot. It could be at 13, it could be at 23, it could be even up to 40 and then jump back down to, you know, 12. So you'll see it move around. So it's not really a great basis to test for where somebody is, you know, if they're technically menopausal. And when I say these numbers in the reference ranges, if you look at, like I said, I kind of feel they're a little bit ridiculous, but if you look at the reference ranges on a lab result that comes in from doing your blood work on an FSH, they have these huge reference ranges that somebody over an FSH over 25 is considered menopausal. And that's,
so you gave like three different FSH numbers there. You said like 12, 23,
40 something. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
So mm-hmm. where, and this is the key point, right? This is part of what doesn't happen conventionally is they never test a woman's hormones, or if they do, they don't pay attention to what day of the cycle they're tested, which you and I always do that, or at least we want to know, right? Sometimes we tell them to go to the lab on specific days. Sometimes we ask them, what day of your cycle were you on? Were you on your period? Were you off your period? Were you close to your period? Was it before, during, or after? So those three numbers you gave, I think you said 12, 23, and 47 or something. Let's just say that, right? Where would they be in that 28-day cycle for each of those numbers?
See, that's where it gets a little interesting.
That's a whole nother episode. Totally, that's yeah. a whole nother episode right totally, there that we should do. How does your FSH match up with the day of your period?
And you know, honestly, in a perimenopausal female, it's hard to say because they may not be ovulating. Because in a menstruating female that's ovulating, they typically, that FSH will start to go up right before ovulation, like around day, you know, 10 to 12, you'll see the luteinizing hormone go up right around ovulation because that's kind of trigger an ovulation, the egg to leave the ovary. So that's a little different. In a perimenopausal female, it could just 1 month be in the 40s and 1 month be in the 12s. It's just depending on, because I always say like the ovaries are a little bit like gremlins when you get into perimenopause. It's like they want to work full time, they want to work part time, they want to work a little bit, they want to go on vacation. They just make their way. And our goal in perimenopause is to kind of work with the ovaries, but not bully them, which you've had patients that have been in perimenopause that their doctors have put them on estrogen. That is one of the, you know, one, if for a menstruating female that's in perimenopause, giving them estrogen isn't always a great idea. They end up feeling worse, or their periods get really wonky or heavy or two in a month.
Or frequent. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So that's where, you know, that FSH level, that's a little bit different. Now, one thing I had mentioned earlier, you know, about a lot of women have been coming to me, maybe, you know, in my earlier years of practicing, oh, my doctor says I'm in menopause, I don't know what to do. A lot of times they'll test their blood work and they might do the estrogen. They might actually do estrogen and progesterone. It's on the lab rec, you have to mark it, but they end up doing their blood work on their period. So they're, and anytime you're on your period, your estrogen and your progesterone are all very low because that's what stimulates the uterine lining to slough off to hence have a period. So the estrogen and progesterone are always low on that those early days of your period. So I'll have these women, they'll bring me in their blood work and they'll say, oh, my doctor says I'm in menopause because their estrogen and progesterone are non-existent. Their FSH is fine, like 6.5 or maybe, you know, 4.
A good FSH is anything pretty much under 10, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Under 10, yeah. Depending on, like I said, the time of the cycle. But so then I'll say, no, you must've been on your period when you had this. Yeah. Yeah. And if they remember, they'll say yes. Just like you were saying earlier, when I'll look at the blood work, sometimes I'll tell people, you know, go in between day 16 and day 21, or I'll give them different dates to go in to get their blood drawn. But usually, you know, you and I can look at where the estrogen level is, where the progesterone level is and say, oh, you know, on your period, you know, I can usually figure out where they are in the cycle just by looking at that.
Yeah, you're pretty good about that. You can.
It's been a lot of years.
You can figure out almost like to the day almost at where they were. I'm not as good at it as you looking at that number, but yeah, you're pretty good at that. Now.
Well, I'm Asian. I like numbers. I like math.
Okay, that's a little cliche. Now I had another question there, and I just you're a little.
Sorry, I got off on a tangent.
Oh, that's all right. It kind of brought up another question. I remember now. So if a menstruating woman, let's say she's 25, her over the course of a month, her FSH isn't going to change very much.
Not too much. Sometimes the luteinizing hormone can go up to maybe the low teens or like 11 or 12.
Especially if she's around ovulation.
Yeah, right before ovulation, right. You can see that. And so sometimes, if I want to go on another tangent, is that's a way that I can differentiate a female that's in that has PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is when you check their FSH and LH levels, if the LH luteinizing hormone is 2 times or higher than an FSH, the follicle stimulating hormone, then you can kind of say, oh, you know, this person, this woman might actually have PCOS. So for example, if you did their blood draw and their LH was 12, but their FSH was 6, that'd be a 2-to-1 ratio. Now, like I said, it gets a little different if we were to catch them right before ovulation, because that luteinizing hormone does come up. So that's, like I said, I went way off on a tangent there.
It's just a little backstory there. So LH surge, which also increases testosterone. So you get an increase in testosterone right around ovulation, which is supposed to raise libido. So that way conception is more likely. If there's sexual activity, but both in males and females, the LH surge both raises testosterone levels. So in a woman that's PCOS, the LH surge can sort of run amok a little bit, and now their testosterone levels a little too high.
Well, what you'll find, especially with PCOS, is that LH number. So then I'll redo it. There's other parameters to check for PCOS, but you'll just, with PCOS, that LH is pretty much double the FSH or higher the whole month long.
Right. Yeah. But my point was, is that both in males and females, that LH number pushes the testosterone number. Men sometimes take either HCG, which is a pregnancy hormone, or they take Clomid, because it actually mimics luteinizing hormone to increase testosterone levels. You know, athletes do that. You know, men that are, you know, not taking testosterone, trying to increase their testosterone, will use either Clomid or Pregnyl, which is a branded version of HCG to raise those numbers. Anyways, another digression. So like I said, that's why I thought this idea was very interesting to kind of parse out. Now, you and I intuitively we don't ask this question necessarily just because we sort of take it for granted. You're deciding where a woman is without consciously deciding where they are. Their symptom profile, kind of what they're experiencing, that includes their period or lack thereof, or the consistency of it, sort of determines where they are almost, regardless of their age. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'd say if you haven't had a blood test, you're not going to have a blood test, you're just not really sure. If you have a uterus and you're having a period, it might not be completely regular, but if you are having a period, then you definitely are more in perimenopause. So that's where it kind of gets into the other tangent of what happens if you don't have a uterus. You had a hysterectomy, maybe for fibroids, for endometriosis, for cysts, for whatever reason. You had a hysterectomy and then you don't know uterus, no period. How do you differentiate if you are in perimenopause, menopause, or maybe not in either?
Yeah, right. I just had a patient actually had a hysterectomy. She's 45, terrible bleeding, had a huge fibroid, I think multiple fibroids, and the bleeding was making her extremely anemic. I saw her medical records from her hematologist, and it had like in all, not bold, but all capital letters, very complicated case.
Oh, really?
He's been a hematologist for, 30 years, and, to the point where she was getting iron infusions, and, so in that context, giving someone some progesterone and whatever isn't going to be enough to stop the bleeding. Because of the fibroid. So, and she's already 45, right? So that, is the uterus really helping her, or is it doing anything for her anymore at that point? Probably not. But they left her ovaries. So we are talking about, technically, is that surgical menopause because she doesn't have a uterus? And we sort of talked about it, that her hormones are probably going to continue to cycle for a while, meaning that timing over the course of a 28-day cycle, even though there's no landmark of a period anymore, in her case, her bleeding is going to go away. Her blood levels, her iron stores and all that stuff should sort of resume. Her CBC, complete blood count, should actually improve over the next several months. Is she still going to have the awareness that her hormones are still cycling?
I actually have several patients like that. And it's funny when we do their blood work, I'll tell them, oh, look, when you had your blood work done, you would have been on your period, or this is a day in the cycle you would have had, because they didn't have their uterus. So they don't know where they are in their cycle. But in some, like you said, with this patient, and I've seen this before too, I'm a big advocate of, hey, surgery, because that's the highest intervention. But there are some cases where that uterus is probably causing more stress to the body than it, just being in there with those fibroids, or even some women with some endometriosis or certain, issues there, probably the uterus wasn't necessary. It is interesting. even 15, not even 15 years ago, when you do a hysterectomy, doctors want to take out the ovaries no matter what age you are. They just take them out. Now it's kind of nice to be able to leave those in there because they know that those hormones can be beneficial. But at the same time, we still want to balance those hormones, whether you have a uterus or you don't have a uterus. But I would say, you know, in terms of surgical menopause, that would be when they did a total hysterectomy, you know, which is hysterectomy removing the uterus, and an oophorectomy, which is removing the ovaries. That would be surgical menopause. They went from hormones to absolutely zero hormones. And I wouldn't say that's a tough cookie to handle. It's actually quite easy, but those women really need some kind of hormonal replacement, whether it's temporary or long-term or whatnot. But that's a big change to go from hormones to no hormones, as opposed to somebody that's kind of gliding into menopause.
Yeah. Now this one that I'm talking about, this patient, she just had it, you know, like mid-February or early February, she had the surgery. So it hasn't been that long. She has the fibroid removed, obviously, from the uterus. But then also there are some, when the surgeon did the procedure, there is also some traces of endometriosis. So if they keep the ovaries, do you think that it could exacerbate the endo or perpetuate some of those symptoms? Or do you think it sort of just resolves or goes in remission once they've had the hysterectomy?
There's so many thoughts on endometriosis. You know, when we went to school, and learn, you know, even I remember in the 90s when I was, you know, in college learning about, embryology and all that, is the thought endometriosis is the lining of the uterus has been seeded outside of the uterus in embryonic development. And so then as you get older, you have these tissue or these cells, these endometrial cells outside of the uterus. So they actually have their own cycle over the 28 days. That's why women with endometriosis can have really bad pain on certain days and not so much pain on other days. That was kind of the history of that theory. Now we're learning a little bit more that there's a lot of autoimmune component to it. If you go in and remove endometriosis, why does it come back? Because you've removed those cells. Why does it come back with a vengeance sometimes? Or why does it not come back? We're learning a little bit more that there's actually a pelvic microbiome that has inflammatory cells. They have, it can have inflammation, or you can have lower inflammation. In women with endometriosis, their pelvic microbiome actually has a lot of inflammation and inflammatory, like TNF-alpha and natural killer cells and all this stuff. So now we're learning a lot more, which is really interesting, because I'd like to see in the next 10 years what we're going to learn more about, endometriosis. And maybe the old theory is totally different than the new theory. A gynecologist friend of mine told me years ago that when he would go and do endometriosis, removal of it, sometimes you might catch him on, catch him on the day of their period when they're having that surgery. And he told me he would see the period, that uterine lining that's supposed to be shedding out, south, was actually going retrograde into the pelvic cavity. That happens a lot with women with endometriosis. So there's so many different things. So to answer your question, as I'm going off on this long, long diatribe, is it's hard to say. Sometimes if her hormones, if she has that fibroid and she was having such a thickened lining and so much bleeding, her hormone imbalance, there probably is a hormone imbalance that needs to be addressed. So in her case, your patient, I could see that maybe the endometriosis could get worse which you're obviously, I'm sure, addressing that hormone imbalance anyway, now without the uterus.
Well, now that she's just not even a month out from surgery, sort of a watch and wait period to see. She is taking some progesterone. She was on a progestin prior to the surgery to see if it would slow down the bleeding. It didn't really do a very good job of that. It did lighten it some, but not enough to fix her anemia. She was still bleeding pretty heavy. Now she's back on, bioidentical 200 milligrams of sustained release progesterone. But we're still just, and we talked about it, just kind of waiting to see what sort of symptoms show up. And we both know too that sometimes it can be very quick. Now, more so if the ovaries are removed, they're going to have symptoms much, much faster. But even if they don't take out the ovaries, they could have symptoms within days, within weeks, within months, or sometimes even up to years. There could be a whole different transition period there. More than likely, it's going to be months. We kind of talked about it. It's going to be at least, 3 months at the earliest, closer to 6 months plus before we have to sort of address anything based on her symptom profile. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I usually wait at least 2 months, because sometimes after having a surgery like that, the ovaries just automatically sort of reduce their production of hormones just because there was a surgery. It's kind of, impactful. And then, so I usually say, well, wait at least 8 weeks, then we'll do kind of some blood work and determine where we want to go with that direction in terms of, is she in perimenopause? Maybe she's not, you know, her ovaries could be cycling just fine. And she just had that, you know, sometimes fibroids run in families. They just happen. A lot of us have fibroids and we don't even know we have them because we don't have any symptoms of it. So, but I would say just because she has endometriosis, there are, like you said, the progesterone's a really nice thing to kind of, to work with kind of with endometriosis. There's a lot of really interesting, like N-acetylcysteine is kind of pretty hot now, showing about reducing down the inflammation of that, the pelvic microbiome, doing curcumin, which is the main constituent out of turmeric, actually is shown to be really beneficial for that endometriosis with kind of calming that microbiome of the pelvic, microbiome. So there's a lot of really interesting things. But in terms of her having that uterus out, like I said, she could be perimenopausal. I wouldn't say she's probably going into menopause because it sounds like she was having, having periods.
Oh yeah. She's having too many periods. I mean, she was bleeding. She was just bleeding all the time. Yeah. I mean, just lasting forever and ever. The volume that she was bleeding was making her severely anemic. That part, I think she'll get some relief, right? She'll obviously be able to build up her, blood and iron stores a little bit better because the blood loss will be gone. So I think she'll feel better initially and then just sort of waiting to see, lack of estrogen sort of symptoms start to show up, if they show up anytime soon. They may not, it might take a while, like you said, because they did leave the ovaries. And that's why these are challenging situations, right? Which is why in medicine, everything is sort of looked at as being black or white. Either you have something or you don't. You got a diagnosis or you don't. Medicine does not do very well when there's gray area. Everyone needs to be treated the same because there's three doses for each condition. If you don't fit into one of those three doses, then there's no way to treat you, right? What we're talking about is a very nuanced sort of a thing. And, you could have, 10 women, 100 women with the same age, same situation, and they're all going to manifest differently post-procedure. Okay. I think that's the reason why this gets challenging for women because, doctors just, they're a little bit, pattern. Now, granted, we're all pattern oriented as human beings anyways, but when it comes to medicine and you're trying to decide between a few different medication options, if it doesn't fit into one of those, then women are sort of left to figure it out, which is why, as I talked about earlier, why I think this shift has happened is because the perimenopausal women, the women in their 40s, pretty much from 40 to 49, 40 to 50, have been sort of marginalized and ignored a little bit. Like they just haven't been really, I wouldn't say they haven't been cared about, but besides birth control pills and, antidepressants and whatever else, these hormonal shifts that women are experiencing have just been, not really dealt with very well.
That's why this question is so cool to talk about because, perimenopause for a female could be, like you said, could be a few months or it could be a few years or it could be up to 10 years, for a woman being in perimenopause. And that, like I said, is different than menopause that, like I was saying, 10 years ago, a lot of doctors were just grouping it as menopause. You're in menopause, you're not in menopause. They didn't really address perimenopause. So I really like this day and age now that we're actually saying, perimenopause is something real. It's something that, we want to look into. Just if you're going to have perimenopausal symptoms for 10 years, that's not fun.
That's a long time. Yeah. Especially in a very busy, stressful time of a woman's life in her 40s. She's working, she's got kids, she's doing all these things. She doesn't have the time to not feel like herself, right? That's why I think that is the piece that is women are looking for solutions because they don't, they're not settling for not feeling, like they did before. I had another thought there too, and I lost it for a second, but it'll come back to me. But it was kind of along those same ideas.
Yeah, the advocacy now in this, 2024 about perimenopause, I would say even back in, when I first started practice 2004 to 2014, that 10-year period, I can tell you so many stories of, I went to my doctor, tried to give me antidepressants, give me benzodiazepine like Xanax, told me to go see a therapist for perimenopause. So yeah. Now I think, like I said, there's that advocacy, we're understanding it and not that I would never advocate for somebody to go take benzos for perimenopause, but hey, we could all see a therapist maybe, but it was interesting to see how it was just in, 10 years how something that had been blown off is now actually being addressed. I think it's awesome.
And now you made me remember now. I don't know when this shift actually happened or when this was change occurred, but I remember for years and years and years, as you know, we don't deal with insurance. We're a cash practice. However, we do bill lab work, or we give people insurance lab requisitions so they can get their lab work paid for through their insurance. Now, that's also changed a little bit too, right? A lot of high deductibles, labs, our insurance companies are putting more costs onto the patient. So we're out of network. We're not contracted with any insurance companies. We're out of network. So sometimes insurance companies won't pay for that, you know, if we request it. So so cash, we do all, we also do for that particular situation, we also do cash labs, and cash labs are oftentimes cheaper than doing it through your deductible, right? So people are actually saving money, even though they're paying cash up front for it, you know, to us, as opposed to paying the lab an insurance-based price, which that's a whole nother thing we'll talk about later. But when we do those things, we have to put diagnosis codes on those lab recs. And I just kind of dawned on me the other day that I don't even know when this was. So we moved to Washington, like I said, in 2017. And I know it was after that some point that there was no diagnosis code for perimenopause.
Oh, yeah. No. We would do hormonal imbalance, fatigue.
There was one. There's a couple for menopause, like menopausal
symptoms.
Endocrine
disorder, I think there was. But yeah, now there is a perimenopause one. What is it? Let's see. Menopause
N95.1 and
N95.9. Wait, differentiate. What differentiate those two?
Well, I know because I just looked this one up the other day.
N95.1 is menopause. N95.9 is perimenopause.
No, N95. Don't quote me on this.
I know, me either. Whatever. Pulling this out of my head.
Yeah. from memory. But, you know, you see the same ICD-10 codes all the time. So, but N95.9 is perimenopause and menopausal disorder.
Oh, okay. And then N95.1 is
menopausal symptoms, okay, or something like that, you know, right? So now they're combined together a little bit, or at least there's a perimenopause diagnosis, which I don't remember exactly.
Cool.
There wasn't one just a few years ago, because I remember you and I would talk about it as we were putting those lab recs. Why isn't there not? And I'm sure we talked about it on a podcast in the past. I'm sure I could probably find one of our previous episodes that there was no diagnosis, ICD-10 codes for perimenopause. And now there's at least a couple.
So times are changing.
Yeah. So at least things are being acknowledged, right? There's some awareness there. I still think there's a, you know, conventional lack of options, right? That's also why we're focusing on that, because bridging that gap, like you said, it's 10 years, right? You know, sometimes it can be, you know, even up to 15, depending on how the late 30s go or how long a woman's menstruating into her 50s. This can be and then you could throw on menopausal symptoms on top of that. We're talking close to easily, you know, 12 to 20 years in some cases. That's a huge component of a woman's life, to be dealing with, you know, symptoms that, you know, she doesn't, you know, that her gynecologist or GP doesn't maybe necessarily know how to deal with very well.
I absolutely agree with you. And birth control pills in your 40s is not a good idea. I'll say that adamantly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now granted, we could have that debate. So birth control pills for any woman is probably not a great idea, but
you're 19 and you don't want your college daughter to go get pregnant. Okay. I can understand that.
Sure. You know, well, pregnancy prevention, what is the average? I think the average woman takes birth control for like 9 years.
Really?
I don't quote me on that one either, but I think that one of the continuing education things we saw at one point, pharmacy credit. I think that was what they said. The average is 9 years.
That was probably before, because now with IUDs and some of the lower hormonal IUDs, that might be different now. Because a lot of times, if someone does need some kind of birth control, I'll actually recommend an IUD over the oral birth control pills.
Yeah.
But for perimenopause,
the lesser of several evils, for sure.
But for perimenopause, I have heard patients and tell me that, you know, their doctor wanted to give them an IUD for their perimenopause. I'm like, I don't know if that's, it might help periods, but that's probably all it's going to do.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That I have definitely seen that. Again, just a limited option for, or just a bad solution for a fairly common problem. You know, so that's why we keep talking about it, because you know, there's something there to talk about. And with the internet and women looking for these kind of answers, you know, that's why we put out this information, because we know that it's really hard to find. You know, just because women come to us, it's like, oh my God, why doesn't my other team of people understand these things?
And that's why we're supposed to be a team. You know, one person right. can't do it all.
Yeah, right, right. But when you're used to as a patient or a you know, person, a consumer sort of navigating the medical landscape, and they don't know that. They don't understand. You go to a gynecologist, you figure they would know those things. You go to your GP, he's a doctor, you figure he would know those things. But, you know, sometimes it, like you said, you just have to know who the right person to go to. But now, having said that, though, you and I work outside of the conventional system. We work tangentially to it. We're sort of part of it in a way, but indirectly, we're part of it, you know, through our patients.
Anyways. Yeah, and we get referrals from other practitioners now that, you know, things are more heard about and talked about. And a lot of doctors, they're like, I don't want to touch your hormones. Go see this person.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, because they sort of know where they're, you know, they're trying to stay in their own lane. They know what they do. You know, I don't tell a cardiologist how to do heart surgery, you know, how to deal with, you know, heart issues. I don't tell an orthopedist how to do a knee replacement. You know, that's why there's different specialties in medicine, because, you know, any doctor, I don't care what the doctor is, they can't know and do it all, right? You have to be somewhat niched in an area, because there's just too much to pay attention to. And that's the only way you, as a practitioner, it is the practice of medicine, right? So there is an acquired amount of knowledge and experience that happens over a course of a career that you can't just pick up a specialty. And, you know, that's why there's residencies and all these different trainings, because it takes a while to accumulate that knowledge and experience for sure. I thought this was an interesting one. She asked the question. It sort of made me pause for a second. I'm like, wait a minute, let's log that one away. Let's talk about it. So any final comments, any other things to say about the difference between perimenopause, early menopause? Are we good on this one?
I think this was great. If any of you listeners have any questions or something you want a little bit more detail on, please go on the website and click on that button that says Ask the Doctor, because we love to explain all this stuff.
Yeah. So till next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.